Word Jam. I left El Paso in the early 70s and moved to Memphis, Tennessee. Yeah, I had my tail between my legs and just gotten out of a bad marriage. And so my old partner, Bill Taylor, had moved to Memphis and was the studio manager at Royal Studios. This is a story about Memphis music in the late 60s and the 70s. Rock and roll and R&B. Memphis had a lot of recording studios, and in this episode of Word Jam, I'm just going to look at three of them. The first one we're going to visit is American Studios on Jackson Avenue.
Give me a ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Lonely days are gone, I'm a-going home. My baby just wrote me a letter.
Well, American was owned by Chips Moman, who produced over 120 chart records. What an amazing feat. Well, the Box Tops were sort of a studio creation. Lead singer Alex Chilton went on to have his own career, his solo career. And I believe he's still out there today.
Anyway, yeah. Ticket for an aeroplane. Ain't got time to take a fast train. Don't let you...
Day after day, I'm more confused. Yet I look for the light through the pouring rain.
Chip's studio band was one of the main reasons he had so many hits. He had Reggie Young playing guitar and Tommy Caldwell playing bass. Bobby Emmons was on organ, and Gene Chrisman was on drums. And you put these guys together, what an amazing sound.
Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away. Oh, give me the beat, boys, and free my soul. I wanna get lost in your rock and roll and drift away.
In a one-week period in the early 70s, over a quarter of Billboard's top 100 hits had been recorded at American Studios.
You didn't act like that when you had it home behind closed doors. All right. Now you act like you're ashamed of the woman. Don't even want nobody to know she's yours. But that's all right. You just walk on, baby. Don't you worry about a doggone thing at all. Because there's some man somewhere who'll take you, baby. Still.
Billy Ray was a preacher's son, and when his daddy would visit, he'd come along. When they gathered around and started talking, Cousin Billy would take me walking. Out through the backyard we go walking. Then he look into my eyes. Lord knows to my surprise, the only one who could ever reach me.
That's a sex machine to all the cheeks.
You're damn right.
This truly was a golden era of music for Memphis. Stax Records was owned by Jim Stewart and Estelle Axton. Get it? Stewart, Axton, Stax. Good way to name a label. They eventually bought a movie theater and surrounded themselves with really good people, including Chip Smallman. They had a falling out, and Chips went across town and started up his own studio, American Studios. Stax had been making some significant local records, and Atlantic Records in New York got wind of them, and Jerry Wexler, their president, made a deal with them. The early Stax recordings were done on a single-track machine, and one of these machines broke down one day, and Atlantic Records sent over Tom Dowd to help fix it.
He went over to Radio Shack and bought a part for it.
Well, Carla and Rufus Thomas had recorded some records with Jim Stewart on his old Satellite Records, which turned into Stax Records. So the day Dowd was in the studio fixing the tape deck, Rufus was in the studio, and they recorded this. We all know the name of the artists that put out hit records, but most of us don't know the name of the people who were behind the record. Call them the rhythm section. And a rhythm section is usually made up of four people, which is a guitar player and a keyboard player and a bass player and a drummer. American Studios had a great rhythm section, as I told you before, and so did Stax. The name of their rhythm section was Booker T and the MGs, which stood for Memphis Gang. I've heard some people call it Memphis Group. The MGs played on a lot of hit records that were done in the 60s and the 70s at Stax.
Baby!
Booker T was on the keyboards, Steve Cropper was on guitar, Duck Dunn was playing bass, and Al Jackson was a drummer. Corner from Stax Records on Lauderdale Street was Royal Studios, which was the home of High Records and Willie Mitchell. High Records' rhythm section was made up of Teenie Hodges on guitar, Leroy Hodges on bass, Charles Hodges on keyboards, and Howard Grimes playing drums. You know, it's a small world because Howard Grimes was actually a protege of Al Jackson, who was Stax's drummer. So he sounded a lot like him. In fact, Al Jackson co-produced, co-wrote, and played drums on the first few big Al Green hits. There's no doubt about it. Al Green was the big star on High Records. But my favorite of all times was Ann Peebles. This particular record I put up to my top five records of all time.
I can't stand the rain against my window, bringing back sweet memories. Yeah, window pane.
Not only is she a great singer, she's also just a great human being.
How sweet it used to be. Just one sound that I just can't stand. I can't stand the
There's no doubt in my mind that in the 60s and the 70s, Memphis was writing a new chapter in the music tree. On one side of town, American Studios was writing a chapter on Southern pop music. 30 minutes away on South Lauderdale Street, Stax was writing a chapter on Southern R&B. And 2 minutes away down the street and around the corner, Hi Records was keeping the funk in funky. All the songs used in this doc were recorded in Memphis. First, we had Can't Get Next to You by Al Green, The Letter by the Box Tops, Drift Away by Dobie Gray, Skinny Legs and All, Joe Tex, Son of a Preacher Man by Dusty Springfield, Shaft by Isaac Hayes, Walking the Dog by Rufus Thomas, Green Onions, Booker T and EMGs, B-A-B-Y by Carla Thomas, Hold On, I'm Coming, Sam and Dave, Let's Stay Together, Al Green, Take Me to the River, Al Green, Tired of Being Alone, Guess Who, Al Green, and finally, I Can't Stand the Rain by Ann Peebles. And the last thing on here is Lou Pride's version of It's a Man's World, recorded using the high rhythm section and the Memphis horns.
I am another man. This is a man's world. And it would be nothing without a woman or a girl. Without a woman or a girl.
Letter from Memphis. When I arrived in Memphis, Tennessee, from El Paso, the moment my boots stepped down from the bus, I wished I'd gone to Memphis, Egypt, instead of this town of broken dreams. Gene Pitney's Town Without Pity, blaring from a jukebox behind my eyes, even my lizard skin boots telling me I was in trouble. My lizards were telling me, "Turn around, asshole. Go back and explain." But no matter how many times I rotated, there I was, in Memphis, Tennessee, with the stink of greyhound on me, and no reason to be there, except I had to leave El Paso or find my severed head and disgorged guts in a trash can. Henry Martinez had it in for me, and he and his brother had a fancy way with an antler-handled buck knife that I was sure my tongue couldn't talk them out of sticking in my gizzard. Word had gone out that they thought I'd wronged their little sister. She must have told them that, but it was pure cactus fuzz, nothing to it at all. I couldn't make how they could believe I'd do that. Henry and Eddie had known me since junior high school. We'd been tokers and had played in a rock band that toured West Texas honky-tonks and saloons for years. We'd laughed together, puked up our innards while listening to wailing coyotes and mesquite-scented summer nights, enjoyed all sizes and shapes of senoritas of most every delicious shade of brown and white. I'd eaten at their family table, and always treated their sister Margaret with the same respect I reserved for my very own little sister. Family is family, though, when it comes to what's the truth, and they believed Margie, believed I'd betrayed them. We hadn't been close for a few years, which Apparently was enough time for my compadres to figure I'd changed into the kind of man who would force an old friend's sister into compromising positions. When my boots hit the sidewalk, I certainly wasn't in the capital of Egypt. This Memphis was muggy, nothing like the land of pharaohs, and no matter how much hooch I swilled, I couldn't imagine myself riding on a fat-lipped camel across a dry, sandy desert toward a pyramid. Nope. It was dusk on Duper Street. My fat, battered motorcycle saddlebags over my right shoulder, I peered out to winos and bums holding up walls of transient hotels in this hopeless neighborhood well beyond the glitz of uptown country bars and performance spots full of young and not-so-young hopefuls who dreamed of taking center stage at the Opry. Before my sudden departure from El Paso, my belt buckle business was on the verge of stability. People were ordering my unique hand-tooled silver buckles customized to clients' specifications, and I was getting good enough at my craft to meet orders on time and for a decent profit. What's more, I was getting to like the work. Lawrence Welk had worn one of my more stylish buckles on his TV show, which resulted in a small rush of orders from folks at the nursing home. Portrait buckles, mostly, and from there word filtered on down to their kids and grandkids. I wouldn't say biz was booming, but it was a living, and I began to look at myself in the mirror as a true craftsman. Then I was nowhere again, back to zero and worse. Henry and Eddie wanted to cut off my head, feed my guts to their parrot Marcel. I figured there had to be a country song in that, and went to the local hawk shop to cash in one of my silver Elvis buckles for a cheap harmony guitar. Sunburst, for a new day. I wrote the song 100 different ways to Sunday, but wasn't happy with any of them. Still ain't. My Mexican leather wallet was getting thinner as its embossed rose molded itself to my ass in the back pocket of my sour, faded blue jeans. A Jewish pal of mine from an El Paso neighborhood of big houses where I once lived with my dad when I was 13, a good and faithful buddy, once told me never to hesitate to call if I needed help. I told him the same, but when I said it, I was sure he'd never need to call me. As adults, our friendship had cooled to a coffee date once every 5 or 6 months, but we both had a common bond in shared childhood experiences when life was painful but simple. Now life was painful, scary, and complicated, and I considered picking up the phone to see if Marvin might wire me alone, no questions asked. I knew he would. And he did. $1,100. I told him where the keys to my Norton motorcycle were, and that he should use my beloved mechanical stallion, hold it for collateral. He said he'd take it for the occasional spin, make sure it stayed tuned for what he figured would be my eventual return. With clean clothes, rent paid up for a few months, and the promise of time to figure a way out, I slept better. I avoided deep relationships, but maintained my well-bred cordiality. Calling elders sir or ma'am came natural, and friendly chatter was just a gift I got from my daddy. I sidestepped attention from the ladies and didn't put myself out there like that, but one day I saw someone. A someone like nobody else. A young woman with hair so black it gave me a small jolt when I saw it framing her face and diving down her back. I wanted her lips. I wanted to fall into those green eyes. I wanted to see her bathing in a large porcelain claw-footed tub filled with milk. If you're a woman listening to this, you know what I wanted. If you're a man, you know what I felt. I dreamt. I desired. And I knew I was only seducing trouble. knew she'd do a snake dance one day that would lead to my sudden early demise or a crushed heart. But she was so beautiful and strange-eyed that I almost didn't care. I called her Cleo for Cleopatra, and she called me Tut. And we were a royal pair in the second-rate whiskey bars up and down Duper Street. I nearly forgot why I was in Memphis. My lizards went into hibernation, went mum. You could say that's the definition of trouble. When your lizards don't guide your feet, and the woman too beautiful for you says yes when you ask her if she'd allow you to buy her a shot of Jack, fate is fucking with you, playing a black joke on your sorry ass, making you forget who you are, why you ran from your home, and deluding you into thinking everything's gonna be all right. I was so into trouble that I'd forgotten all about it. I'd forgotten entirely about Henry and Eddie. I had a job cleaning and repairing jewelry at Mencken's House of Jewels. I was beginning to get on my feet again. That other fellow I'd been who had suffered a bad knock became nothing but a mummified memory, and I was all wrapped up in imagining a future full of love and sex and babies. Cleo and I couldn't keep our hands off each other, and months of besotted nights of love and rum and whiskey and jukebox jive spun a dream that only came to an end the night Henry and Eddie and their parrot Marcel jumped out at us in the parking lot behind the Pear-O-Dice Lounge. The rolling dice were flashing garish red and green and yellow above us as the illusion of rolling neon cubes always came up seven. Marcel, perched high on Henry's shoulder, squawked, "Motherfucker! Motherfucker!" which had always cracked me up in the past. Now I felt sick with terror as I turned back to face the brothers, and nobody smiled. With their flat, poker-faced expressions, their dead eyes fixed on mine, and their buck knives menacing mirrors reflecting the neon dice and Cleo and me and their blades, I felt like I was in a noir movie. I even considered yelling, "Cut!" But that would have been a poor choice of language just then, and this was real. The whole thing was based on a lie, but the consequences would be no less truthful for having grown from Margaret's deceit, and I knew there was no leverage in calling Margie a liar. Instead, I thought it best to catch them off guard, and even though I knew it was nothing anyone had ever want to record, I thought I could tap into our past, those days when we played together in the band, and I sang them my song, desperately hoping they'd listen and that it might save my life and keep Cleo from harm. Memphis Showdown. When I met you, you were just a little girl. I knew your brothers and you became my sister. One day you grew long and lovely, but you were always like a little sister. Don't think I didn't see you as the woman you'd become, but your brothers were like brothers, and you were always just my sister. I would never be your mister. I could never be your mister. Now you turned your brothers on me, made them Cain, and turned me Abel, though you knew I could never be your mister. And now, like in the Bible, I've been banished to a fable, been maligned and labeled, and driven to a table where a knife awaits my life. I sit across from your brothers and ask them to remember when their mother was my mother and you were always my sister. You've always been my sister, never been nothing but my sister. So tell 'em, little sister, that I've never, ever been your mister. When I finished singing, I prepared to meet my maker. I'd done my best, which was pretty bad. And Eddie stared at me from that flat, expressionless face, dark eyes boring a hole in my head clear to the back of my skull. Neither of us blinked for an eternity, and I thought the next thing I'd see would be a buck knife twirling, shank over blade over shank over blade, until it would stick in my forehead. Instead, I saw one small tear roll out from the inner corner of Eddie's left eye. He coughed once and grunted. Like the bird says, you are one dirty motherfucker. But I don't guess you're a sister fucker. You still go for the Cuba Libres? He holstered his knife. His brother Henry, shuffling his right foot over scattered pebbles, looked entirely disinterested. Turned to his brother and said, pussy. I told you from the start you're going to pussy out and let the fucker off the hook. He still had his buck knife in hand as he beer burped, what the hell? He shifted his eyes up and down Cleo and, barely moving his lips, asked, and what's your friend drink? As he flipped his knife up in the air, catching it behind his back, Cleo piped up, Jack, with a Coke back. We marched in through the dice's creaky door under the neon sevens and drank until the night went swirling down a foggy mess of Memphis. Beautiful, black-haired Cleo and her lies went home with Henry that night. Eddie felt real bad about that and insisted I take Marcel, who kept squawking,
Motherfucker!
Until I shoved him in the closet. I kissed Memphis goodbye for good the next afternoon, sold my lizards for a couple of sawbucks, grew a handlebar mustache, and moved to Memphis, Egypt, where the insomniac night has a thousand green eyes.
Oh, it isn't very pretty.
Word Jam 33.